previously on Unsolved. Krzyzewski was really hoping the hypnosis would help the waitresses remember what kind of car the couple was driving, the license plate number, which direction it was headed, something that would be helpful. But when that didn't work, he turned to a police sketch artist. Rosie can still remember what the couple looked like.
She had bushy hair. If I remember correctly, it was sort of black. Sort of a big woman, and he was a little man.
And the police in Watertown didn't put a lot of stock in the clues Krzyzewski was uncovering. But then Krzyzewski released the sketch of the couple and the story about Michelle being in the white car to the media. After that, Chief Reynolds decided to reopen the case. For the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I'm criminal justice investigative reporter Gina Barton. This is Unsolved Season 2, A Toddler's Death, A Tangled Trail. One of the most promising tips about the sketch came from a Watertown woman named Sharon Blazing, who said she recognized the man. She said he was a house painter, an ex-Navy sailor, and a convicted child molester. His name was James Dunn. Everyone called him Jim. And he was Sharon's ex-husband. Karen Cole, who was friends with the couple, told me Sharon had left her first husband and was raising three little girls on her own when she met Jim.
And then her first husband beat her half to death. I mean, he actually did beat her close to death. And she ended up in the hospital, and then ultimately she divorced him. Jim came along and helped her. I mean, Sharon was not in a position where she didn't cook. She didn't do most anything. Jim came along and started being the home life nurturer and took care of the whole family, plus working.
Sharon's brother, Dennis Baldwin, told me the couple got along well at first. But within a couple years, Jim's drinking started to cause trouble between them.
You never knew where you stood with the man. He was, I would say, kind of on the nervous side. And he also was an alcoholic. And, well, like all alcoholics, he'd say he wasn't going to drink anymore. Well, that would go on for maybe 6 weeks. And then it would be another round of drinking. And he spent a lot of money that he didn't have.
Sharon and Jim have both since passed away. So we pieced together their story by talking to people who knew them and by reading police reports and court files. In one of the police reports, Sharon told them about Jim's problems with alcohol. Here's what she said, as read by a narrator from our newsroom.
In October of 1973, Jim was drinking quite heavily. I kicked him out for a few months. Then he came back and he stayed sober for quite a while. It was probably around May or June he was drinking again. Often I didn't see him for days at a time.
Jim eventually got sober.
He was an alcoholic for a long time, but he stopped drinking, and he worked.
But a few years later, something happened that destroyed their marriage. Dennis told me about it.
As far as with Sharon, he was fine with Sharon, but after they were married, oh gosh, it was probably 6-7 years. Then one of the girls said something about his goings on. And
when Dunn and Blazing got married, Jim Dunn adopted the three girls. And so he had pretty much raised them since they were little. When they were 17, 14, and 10, they told their mother that he had been molesting them for years. Dunn was charged with 4 felonies, and Sharon testified at his preliminary hearing. Here's our narrator again, reading from a transcript.
When I found out what happened, I screamed at him, how could he do that? He had several answers. He said every time he walked in the house, he could smell douching powder, and I told him he was out of his tree because the girls didn't even know what that was, and that, you know, he kept checking them for that reason. I told him that, I wasn't going to let it go, that I'd blow it wide open. There was no way that it would go on.
Jim Dunn ended up pleading guilty to 3 felonies, but Karen says she never really believed he was guilty.
It's hard to describe Sharon, because sometimes she'd be so in outer space it was tragic, and other times she'd be very grounded. And you're talking about Jim Dunn and probably about the so-called child molestation. I questioned her, and so did my husband at the time. And I told her, I said, Ted and I both really doubt that this is reality. She said, oh, no, it is. It just is. She would hear nothing but that Jim had molested the girls. I just thought he was a kind man, and I thought he was, I don't know, he came to me after the whole thing came apart. And he said, Karen, I really did not touch those girls. He had tears in his eyes, and he said, I wish you would believe me. And I said, I do.
I told Dennis that one of Sharon's friends was questioning whether Jim was guilty. He started protesting before I could tell him it was Karen.
Oh, I'd like to know who that was. I know you probably can't tell me, but I'd probably get into trying to do something to straighten them out a little bit.
So, I really don't know. I just keep coming back to, he pled to 3 felonies. After that, Jim and Sharon got divorced. Sharon saw the sketch about a year after Michelle disappeared in 1981. And when she did, she called the private investigator and she told him, hey, the guy in the sketch looks a lot like my ex-husband. So the police came out to talk to her, and one of the first things she told them was about a day in August 1980 where her husband at the time got home from work, and he was a roofer and a house painter, and he asked her to clean out his truck. Here's what she told the police about that day.
At the time, it looked like Rust-Oleum was smeared inside the truck, on the seats and on the floorboard. But thinking back on it, I feel like it possibly could have been blood. My daughters cleaned it out.
So the police went to question Dunn. Not only did he deny any involvement in Michelle's death or anyone else's death, he said he never sexually abused the 3 girls. Here's what he told the police, as read by another narrator from our newsroom.
I didn't do anything to them. I was only convicted because I kept my mouth shut and went along with what the lawyer told me to do. I didn't want to go to prison for 20 years, so I just did what my lawyer said.
It became clear to the investigators pretty quickly that Jim Dunn was not involved in Michelle's disappearance, because on the day she disappeared, he was actually in jail serving the jail sentence that he had received for molesting his wife's daughters. But Sharon thought he could still be involved in some of the other unsolved disappearances and deaths in Jefferson County at the time. Around the time he was disappearing for days because of his drinking, a 16-year-old girl named Kathy Schoberg disappeared from an after-prom party at a banquet hall called the Concord House. And the day Jim had asked Sharon to clean out his truck could have been August 9th, 1980, the day that teenage sweethearts Timothy Hack and Kelly Drew disappeared from a wedding reception, also at the Concord House. Jim and Sharon had owned some farmland in Jefferson County, and Sharon told the police they should search for the teenagers' remains on that land.
She said she smelled the bodies out at the farm. That's what we referred to it as, the farm. And she said she smelled the bodies out there. And then she said that the police were constantly following her around. I don't believe she actually worked with the police other than that one time. And I remember her saying they went through all the sheds and everything else.
I asked Karen what they were looking for in the sheds.
Anything, any evidence they could find. as to whether or not the couple had been murdered there or not, or the child.
Sharon also gave the police some books that they found pretty disturbing. And in these books, there were descriptions of satanic cults and different witchcraft kind of practices. There was information about human sacrifices and drowning unbaptized children and then using the water to bless the cult members. The police asked Jim Dunn about these books and what was in them. Here's what he said.
I've never been involved in any cults or any Satanism. The only one interested in that stuff was Sharon. Those aren't my books. They belong to Sharon. She was into that screwy stuff long before she met me. If she wants to practice that stuff, it's okay with me. She's just plain screwy.
On this point, I'm fairly convinced Jim Dunn was telling the truth. Sharon's friend Karen confirmed it for me.
We both enjoyed psychism. Psychism is spirituality where I read tarot cards. And she did what is called the I Ching. It's spelled I-C-H-I-N-G. And it's called the Chinese Book of Changes. And then she did something else. And I understand it's a way of hypnotizing yourself so that you put your mind in a certain place so that, how do I explain this? Well, it's kind of like being hypnotized. And so therefore you go into this, your super subjective mind, and you can sometimes see things.
Sharon also told the police she thought Jim, and maybe even Karen, were involved in some sort of satanic cult. And she claimed its leader was some sort of defrocked priest.
Because, you know, I was a devil worshiper, Jim was a devil worshiper, her ex-husband was a devil worshiper, and it's just insanity. I actually personally feel that she was schizophrenic.
But from the police reports, it seems like when they talked to Sharon, they took her pretty seriously. So this led the police to go look for a former priest, or several, any that they could find, who had known Jim Dunn. And the police found a man named Ed Large, who wasn't actually a defrocked priest. He was a former seminarian. So he had studied to be a priest, but left the seminary before he became a priest, and he was married to a woman who had left the convent and was a former nun. Ed Large died not long ago, but I did reach the former nun, whose name is Irma Large. They divorced a while back, but she told me they remained close. She said the rumors that they had some sort of forbidden love affair before she left the convent and before he left the seminary weren't true.
I met him because I came back to my hometown, you know, and he happened to be, you know, near the hometown, and somehow or other people sort of, you know, this was a good story, and not in a priest running around together. But I left for my own personal reasons. I did not know Ed before that. I think he had been out a good year or maybe a bit more.
Irma said she had never heard the allegation that maybe Ed was part of some kind of cult. In fact, she says they stayed pretty active in the Catholic Church.
You know, we sort of lived, you know, the first, like, 10 years around our hometown, you know, and participated. I was an organist, you know, because some of that was, what I was trained to do. And then when we made our move to Watertown and bought our business, you know, we continued, you know, to stay involved in that parish, and I was the choir organist, so obviously I had involvement, you know, in maintaining, you know, the Catholic tradition, and he did too.
Irma told me she didn't know Sharon Blazing or Jim Dunn. I told her about the police report and how it said Ed and Jim Dunn met at Alcoholics Anonymous. She said that made sense.
We married in 1964. The next 10 years of our marriage, he struggled with alcoholism and then reached recovery. You know, Ed continued recovery for almost 40 years. So he was a very strong, the Order of Alcoholics Anonymous and been at his memorial this past, you know, this summer. There were many people that came forward that remember, you know, the help that he gave to them.
So the police asked Ed Large if he knew anyone in the Manders family or any of the suspects in Michelle's case besides Jim Dunn. He said, well, you know, it's AA. We don't use last names. There is a woman named Jan who I've met through AA. She was thin and blonde, which did match the description of Michelle's mom, Jan. The other thing that Ed said about this woman was that she didn't really seem to have an alcohol problem. She seemed more to have psychological problems. Early on, the police had considered Michelle's mom, Jan, a suspect in her disappearance. I think part of that was due to the fact that kind of the parents are always the first suspects in a case like this. Orville Kwame, the detective, told me he also found it sort of strange that Jan had called Joe Mueller, her friend Terry's husband, that morning after she discovered that Michelle was missing.
As I recall, the statement at that time is that Jan found Michelle missing, and she in turn called Joe over and talked to him about it. Okay? That's my understanding. Now, it's been a long time, and that's as I recall. And there was some, the reason I recall that is that there was some question as to why the hell would she call Joe over when her daughter was missing instead of calling the police right away.
Jan says that Joe called her, that she's not the one who called him. And Detective Kwame insists that in his memory, Jan called Joe before she called the police.
Unfortunately, the good solid leads were Jan and Terry and Joe.
A couple of days after Michelle disappeared, the police asked Jan if they could search her house.
So I said, fine. And I went away for an hour. So when I came back, and they were finishing up, and I seen them with my white uniform from work. What are you doing taking my uniform for work?
The police told her there was a red stain on the uniform that looked like blood. Jan said they didn't listen when she tried to explain that it wasn't blood, it was liquid food from the nursing home. One of the residents she was feeding didn't like it and spit it on her.
You know, I didn't do anything to her. I just felt very threatened for some reason. And that they're not going to be looking for who did it if they're going to be continuing looking at me. So I would like to give them any chance of probable cause to get them to draw attention to other people because I know I didn't have anything to do with it. But I didn't care for the fact that they were assuming that was blood on something when it wasn't. And I thought, oh, this is going to go bad for me here.
Mike Manders, who is Michelle's dad, was out of town when Michelle disappeared. And so the police were able to confirm that pretty quickly. He was in Appleton on a job, so he couldn't have had anything to do with her disappearance because he wasn't there. They did talk to him about Jan. They asked him about their relationship. He said, you know, they had had their ups and downs, but lately they'd been getting along pretty well. Mike told the police the only thing he and Jan ever fought about was money. This was back in the day before a direct deposit or any of that. And since Mike traveled a lot, when he got paid, his paychecks would be mailed to his home address in Watertown. So generally, Jan was there, and Mike wasn't there when the checks arrived, so he told the police that she would just cash them right away. And they started getting behind on the bills. Mike told the police this story, and Jan told me another version of this story, during which they had a big argument, and Mike threw an iron. Now, Mike told the police that he was just angry and he just threw the iron. He wasn't trying to hit her, but it did sort of ricochet off something and hit Jan in the head. Jan says she thinks he was intentionally trying to throw it at her, and it hit her in the back of the head.
This is the time he had thrown the iron at me, and it hit me in the back of the head this time. And I got a pretty good dodge in the back of my head.
One of the things the police wanted to know from Mike was whether he thought Jan was having an affair. This could be for a couple of reasons. There have been lots of cases where a mother will kill a child or children because the new boyfriend doesn't want them in the picture. So maybe this could have been something like that. The other thing that they were suspicious of is whether Jan was having an affair with Joe Mueller, who was her friend Terry's husband, and who kind of had a reputation in town as being kind of a small-time criminal, an unsavory character. Terry told me the police thought Jan and Joe were seeing each other. A few months before Michelle disappeared, the Wisconsin Supreme Court banned the use of polygraph evidence in court. And the reason why they did that was because they thought that while it could be useful in some cases, that it depended too much on who was interpreting the result. Even after polygraph tests were banned from being used in court, police officers still use them during investigations. And even now, a lot of investigators consider them a useful tool. Some detectives and police officers still rely on them and have a lot of faith in their ability to tell whether someone's lying. So they asked Jan to take a lie detector test. She remembers it being really stressful.
I was almost completely finished, and I walked out of the room. I just couldn't know if I could take any more. And he said, you only have a little more to go. Please come back in and try to finish it up. And I thought, fine, if it'll keep you from thinking that I was going to do it with my daughter, I'll do it. I'll finish it. No problem. I went back in there and I finished up the lie detector test. And they told me, after I finish, I pass.
Detective Kwame confirmed that.
Yeah, there was no indication that she was being deceptive.
They also tried to track down this blonde woman named Jan from the Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and realized that, no, that was not Jan Manders. So there was no connection between her and the former seminarian and the cult, if there was one. Sharon Blazing, Jim Dunn, and Ed Large were ruled out as suspects. Jan passed the polygraph, so she was off the list too. The only one not eliminated was Joe. And the main reason for that was what happened with his polygraph exam.
I think he had a couple of them. And I'd have to say the FBI polygraph operator certainly was stressed out with him during the polygraph. He had apparently had a polygraph previously, and it was some concern because when I asked him what his name was, it indicated he was lying, even though it was his true name. I think whatever the polygraph operator did to get a baseline, I think he was frustrated. He couldn't get one.
After hearing so much about Joe from the cops and his ex-wife and Michelle's family, my producer and I decided we needed to track him down and talk to him ourselves. And we did. Next time on Unsolved.
Well, I know they told the Manders a bunch of lies about me.
Yeah.
And then they tried to relate it to my son disappearing. Or he didn't disappear, he died from SIDS.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they tried to put all of the other, because I went to visit the man there shortly after, and he asked me where his daughter was. I said, how the hell am I supposed to know?
From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved, A Toddler's Death, A Tangled Trail. Support our independent investigative work by subscribing to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Find the latest offers at jsonline.com/subscribe. You can find more online at jsonline.com/unsolved. Subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. Unsolved is reported by me, Gina Barton, and produced by Katie O'Connell. The project was edited by Greg Borowski, with web design by Aaron Coy, photos by Mark Hoffman, graphics by Lou Saldivar, and video by Lou Saldivar and Bill Schultz. Our copy editor was Debbie Davis, with social media outreach by Emily Risto. Andrew Malika worked on interactive graphics.